Hello, and welcome to the Off the Table podcast. We are a group of global health enthusiasts from diverse backgrounds who deeply care about improving access to surgery worldwide and believe that the solutions come from the ground up. Your hosts, Amuna, Reem, Paul, and myself, Emily, will aim to create a safe environment to have comfortable and uncomfortable conversations about equitable surgery. We aim to be impactful by sending a concrete and evidence-based call to action after each conversation. We truly hope you enjoy these conversations as much as we do.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to episode 7 of the Off the Table podcast. My name is Dr. Sharsa Jaharifard, and today my co-host James Kennedy and I are excited to interview the amazing husband and wife duo, Dr. Shaila Devi and Dr. Nandakumar Menon, founders of the Ashwini Association for Health Welfare in the Nilgiris Foundation and the Gudalar Adivasi Hospital, and champions of global surgical care and healthcare education. Welcome, Dr. Shaila and Dr. Nandakumar.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much for coming. Perhaps we could begin by having you tell the audience a little bit about yourselves, where you grew up, what made you want to become medical doctors and surgeons, and what you like about the profession. Why don't we start with Shaila?
Hi. I was brought up mostly in Trivandrum, which is the capital of Kerala, one of the states in southern India. Kerala is known for its female literacy and its very high, its very good health indicators. Because of that, I had the opportunity to study as well. My parents are both being highly educated and are academicians, and they, of course, encouraged us to study. And as for going into medicine, I think we really didn't have much career options in the days when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s. You became either a doctor or an engineer if you wanted to survive. And thankfully, I chose the former because I really loved the subject and have had a great time practicing medicine. And I did both my undergrad and post-graduation in Trivandrum Medical College, a large government-run medical college in Trivandrum. It was great because we had a huge caseload and a lot of experience while training. On to Nandakumar.
Hi. So I grew up in Calcutta in West Bengal. My parents had moved there from Kerala as my father found work in Calcutta. And my mother, after she had her three kids, became a homeopathic doctor. She they encouraged us a lot in our studies, and I was very interested in biology and liked to go into medicine. I was fortunate to get into the Christian Medical College, Bellore. From the beginning itself, I was quite keen that I would be working for poor people and the underprivileged. And CMC Bellore had a long history of supporting such students, as well as that kind of a vision. After I completed my medical schooling, I was a little confused about whether I should go into medicine or surgery. So I took a year off and went to a very busy rural hospital where I found that to work in a rural area, you really needed to have surgical and obstetric skills. These are two critical skills that were necessary. So I decided to become a surgeon. We are from a fairly middle class background, and my parents had a lot of expectations from me. So I had certain financial obligations. So I thought if I would go to the US, I would get a very good surgical residency program, see the world and make some money as well. So I proceeded to apply and was accepted in the surgical program in the US.
Yes, and actually later on in the podcast, we're gonna ask you a little bit about your journey to working in the US to coming home to India, because we heard a story that you had decided that you were going to save up just $100,000 and come back and start the hospital. So we're going to get to that later. But first, can you tell us a little bit about your journey to starting Ashwini and the Gudalar Adivasi Hospital? Can you tell us a little bit about this area of India and why it was important for you to work there?
After I finished during my surgical residency itself, I had visited India a number of times. And I would always go back to these hospitals, the rural hospital I worked in, just to see if I would fit back in India. I finished my residency and joined Westchester County Medical Center as part of the staff. And at that point, I got married to Shaila, who was doing her internship at Trivandrum Medical College. We both came back to India because I felt that it was very important for her to see what was happening in the US, since all my stories were US related. So we spent time in the US where we had our first child, and I then did my FACS, and we spent time. And during that time, we actually were contemplating on our future, and Shaila was quite okay with working in a rural area, which I must say is quite very fortunate for me, since we had an arranged marriage. So we decided against her doing her obstetrics. Shaila was quite open to going into different higher specialties, but we decided that obstetrics would be the most important. So we decided that she would not do her residency in the US, because that would take a long time by the time she would finish and so on. So we decided that we'd come back to India, and Shaila would proceed to do her post-graduation program there. So while we were working, I was very keen on my parents, all the objectives that they wanted. So I was trying to get them all done one by one. And I felt that if I had $100,000, that would be enough for life savings for us. So I thought that would be enough. Being doctors, we knew that we would, we would survive one way or the other in India. So we were quite confident about our lives. So I was happy that I could take care of my parents and satisfy their obligation, my obligations to them as far as finances is concerned.
Yeah, you were asking about this particular area. Gudalur is in the, it's actually the foothills of Ooty, the famous hill resort in the Western Ghats. The community that we work with, they're called the Adivasis. Adivasi means Adi means original, and Vasi is the dweller. So these are the original dwellers in this area. This was once a very densely forested area where, humans really couldn't come in. It was full of wildlife and a malaria-ridden area. And there are about 20,000 odd tribals that live here. They're classified actually by the government as particularly vulnerable tribal groups. They were called primitive tribes earlier, but they've changed the name to particularly vulnerable tribal groups. And, these are people who really have not come in touch with the mainstream society until very recently. And when they see an outsider, they actually run into the forest and hide. Mm-hmm. Stan, the person who founded the organization, started working here initially, he has pictures of an entire village from far away. And then when you go near, you can only see those little eyes peeping through the bamboo. They've all gone and hidden. These are the kind of people we are talking about. And they had zero healthcare. They had nothing. They had no maternal care, no child care. Everybody delivered at home. The maternal mortality here was, incredible. We hear the story of a particular village. So they have this culture of burning down the hut if a mother dies in her pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And there is a little village nearby with about 200 families, I would say, where there were three recently burned huts.
Wow.
That was the kind of here during the time there were deaths from diarrhea, vitamin deficiencies. It was pathetic. And they were not accessing any kind of healthcare. And the reason we decided to come here was that during Nanda Kumar's travels, he came across the work that had been started here by doctors Deva and Rupa. They were 10 years junior to him at CMC Vellore. And soon after they finished their medical school, they had come here and started a community health program. And they were desperately looking for someone to start a hospital, because there were so many sick people who would not go anywhere else for care. And they felt that they need to have their own hospital, which is the reason why we decided to come here. It was also a beautiful place, cool spot. So that helped us well.
So to backtrack a little bit, how did we come to Gudalur? Actually, once we came back to India and Chala joined the Trivandrum Medical College as a postgraduate in obstetrics and gynecology, I joined as a junior surgeon there, and I got quite a bit of free time. So I was traveling around the country looking at various needy areas right across the whole country, from Orissa to Jharkhand, Chhattisgarh, and so on. And many of my seniors were working in these areas. So I visited them to find out what were the problems, what are the skills that were required. And I was very fortunate that in Trivandrum Medical College, they thought I was crazy because I requested all kinds of postings. So I spent 6 months in anesthesia because I realized that that's the most critical thing that we need. And I did a few months of pediatric surgery. They were very nice to me and helped me.
I'm glad to hear.
They really didn't think I was going to go and work in the village, but they humored me. So I learned a lot. They really went out of their way to teach me. So I tried to collect all the skills that we would need to work in a rural area. And meanwhile, I kept scouting around. And that's when we heard about Gudalur. In those days, it's very difficult to find out the needy areas. You actually had to physically travel to these spots to find out what was going on because the internet wasn't there. And that's one reason why recently we started this website called ruralhospitalnetwork.org. So the youngsters today can have access to all these different hospitals on this website.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I think those of us in North America listening in, and perhaps in most parts of the world, aren't aware that there is an indigenous population in India. Can you tell us a little bit about their history in India and how they've been marginalized in their access to social services, healthcare, education, in the modern history of your country?
Actually, India has 8.6% of India's population. That's close to, it's around about 200 million people, 160 million people. That's like many large countries in India are actually Adivasi or tribal. And the fantastic thing is that India has, despite the fact that it's the second largest population in the world, we still have a massive amount of forest cover. And it's only because of the Adivasi people who live within the forest and who took care of it for centuries and centuries and centuries. They were largely left undisturbed by the other population who would have interactions with them, mainly bartering in the old days before 400 or 500 years ago. The tribals would be in their forest doing their thing and had interactions with the outsiders who would want to go through the forest or would trade with them by bartering. But once the country became occupied, there were people who wanted to convert parts of the forest into agricultural areas. And so, for example, in Gudalur, large tracts were then converted into tea estates. As a result of this, large areas of forest became converted into agricultural or cash producing plants. And the tribals were displaced. So the problem with the tribals who were displaced was, one is that they had no knowledge of what was happening outside. They had no clue about the government services and so on. And the second is that they were not literate in the way to survive in the non-tribal world. They were literate as far as the forest was concerned. They were the masters of the forest. But unfortunately, once the forest became part of the government, they lost their right to be owners of the forest, which they were for centuries, and the trustees of the forest. So that was a situation that we found, especially in areas like Gudalur, where the tribals have been totally asked to leave the forest. So they're actually being removed from the forest because these are sanctuaries, tiger sanctuaries. So in many parts of the country, large sanctuaries were being created, and there's been displacement of the tribals from these areas to the surrounding non-forested areas. So this has been a lot of loss of the traditional way of life, loss of their self-esteem, you can say, because they've, from being the masters and lords of the forest, become the bottom of the socioeconomic pool. They have, as laborers, there's a huge change in the way other people looked at them because they were illiterate as far as living in the non-tribal world is concerned. So that's had a huge blow to their self-esteem. So currently, if you look at the country, large tracts of the forest are still inhabited by the tribals, but there's a lot of restriction in what they can do. So it's not possible for them to, for example, kill animals like they did in the old days. So a lot of this has changed. And as a result of which, many of them are still quite uneducated. and economically impoverished.
Thank you both so much for that incredible origin story. I just wanted to ask a question about that website, ruralhospitalnetwork.org. Could you maybe elaborate on sort of what that platform is for?
Well, as we said, in our time, we had hardly any contact with any kind of information as to where the need was. And very recently, there was a junior doctor who came to our hospital, and she was lamenting how it was so difficult to find out where medical students and young doctors could go and work in India. But there was no such platform. Now, this has been on my mind for a long time, saying that it's so difficult for youngsters to really look out and find out which part of the country do they really need us? Where is the need? You know, how can I go and be a part of the solution? So we decided that we would start a website. And with on the website, what we wanted was hospitals in rural areas where they could put in activities in the hospital and all their needs. For example, if you needed a surgeon or whatever it was, we would list all those needs. It would also be a platform for medical students to come and see, where they could come and volunteer. Surgeons or physicians or any professional, any health professional could look for vacancies there as well as opportunities to volunteer. And we have a lot of Indians and others abroad who are well-trained, would like to come and you know, come and work for a few months and so on. And this would be a perfect website for them to see which are the hospitals where they're actually looking for a particular specialty or looking for people to come and help. Now, some of these organizations are like one person run. So volunteering was one big thing. So the platform is totally free. And there's an application form to fill in, and then you are posted on the website with all the vacancies and all the opportunities. And right now we have 20 hospitals, and we would like that to expand across the country. We have also access to two large networks, the Christian Mission Hospitals, which we can access through our website. So two of the Christian Mission Hospital network, as you know, these are the hospitals that are mostly in very remote parts of the country. So through our website, you can actually access those websites as well. And we would like this to become a pan-India thing. Right now, it's been mostly Southern India and a few Northern Indian states, but we've only started recently, just in July last year. So we're hoping this will become a platform for youngsters and those interested in providing care.
That's phenomenal. We'll absolutely link that in our description for the podcast for anyone in our audience, either from inside India or outside India, who's interested in volunteering or visiting any of these wonderful hospitals. James, back to you with your next question about the Adivasi.
Yes. So how difficult was it for the Adivasi people to develop health-seeking behavior, considering their historical persecution, which led to mistrust and reluctance to receive external healthcare? How were you able to really empower them to gain confidence in your system and embrace their own medical autonomy?
Yeah, the beginning was very, very difficult. They just would not come forward for this very alien concept of modern medical care. And like I mentioned before, you know, they would just run away when we went there. And I think the biggest turning point was when we started training people from the community as health workers. So the first batch of about six women with some leadership from the villages who came forward to be trained as health workers and to understand what they were dying from and what illnesses they were facing and how diarrhea came from drinking unhealthy water. So all these, this information, they had formal training sessions with Drs. Deva and Rupa. And when they went back to the village and talked to the people, and then they accompanied the doctors to the village, there was more cooperation from the people. And there was zero immunization in those days. There was an epidemic of measles in some of the villages. And one of the first immunizations they did was for measles. They didn't. And the health workers came forward with their children to be immunized and were followed by the rest of the villagers. And they found that the children who were immunized did not get measles. And these were, you know, major turning points in getting them onto our side. And, you know, more and more health workers were trained from different villages, and the work spread, and talking about drinking safe water. Initially, the focus was all on preventive measures and maternal and child health, because those were the two most vulnerable populations. And I think once they started seeing the kind of changes, once they started seeing a patient who was dying of diarrhea coming back home alive and well, they started seeing patients with TB who had been bedridden for months come back nice and strong, you know, then the tide turned and people became more confident that this line of treatment would work. And they slowly started filtering into the hospital for care at the hospital.
So what I'm hearing from you is that it's time and patience and making open bonds and partnerships with the community that you're serving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Making bonds with the community is critical, that we are all in this together. And making them part of all your discussions and showing them, you know, how sometimes you might have a plan, but sometimes they may say that, no, let's do it this way. And to listen to that and have a partnership and do it together.
I think the main thing is that they started trusting us. There's been so much of exploitation by the non-tribals that they were very wary of outsiders. But once we were able to establish that we were there for them, the trust grew. Fear was unbelievable. The amount of fear that they had when they came to the hospital was just unbelievable. But gradually over time, as they came back and they were looked after well, and since the staff were tribal and spoke their language, they were comfortable and they started trusting us and allowing us to, you know, do surgeries or whatever was necessary for their care.
I think we read, James and I, somewhere on your website that a vast majority of the employees of the hospital at this point are from the Adivasi community. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, actually 75% of our staff are from the tribal community. These are all young girls and boys who joined us when they were, say, 17, 18, and they have been trained on the job. So we have two main groups of people, the group that works in the hospital, those are the nurses, the lab technicians, the accountants, the pharmacists. These are all mostly from the tribal community who have been trained. They've gone through various training programs. And recently in the last 5-6 years, we have what's called an auxiliary nurse midwife training program, which is a government recognized 2-year nursing program. We take on about 20 girls every year and train them to be nurses. The other group is the field staff. Do we call them the health animators? They are like community health nurses. So they also spend time in the hospital. So they understand disease and its management. They understand delivery and newborn care, but they work in the villages. And there are 8 area centers. They work out of these 8 area centers. It's a large area that we cover because the villages are very scattered. So we have divided that into 8 areas, and there are 8 area centers out of which the health animators work, providing mostly preventive care, but also primary curative care. And they refer them to the hospital if they need to come here. So most of the midwives, the people in the labor room, they're all from the tribal communities. And we also try our best. We have 4 different tribes in this area. And we try to get people from all the tribes to be staff. So there's someone who speaks their language, understands their culture, understands their fears when they come here. That makes them a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, we associate community health workers with a lot of preventative services, but we don't typically associate community health workers with surgery or obstetrics and gynecology. So I was hoping you might touch a little bit upon what role that your community health workers or animators, as you called them, play in encouraging people to come to the hospital for surgical services or perhaps to case find or follow up after surgical procedures are carried out at the hospital.
The health animators are basically, as Shara said, community health nurses. And what they do is they have about approximately 2,000 or 3,000 people under their care. And they know these individuals personally. They know each one of them. And they have a great standing in the community because these are people who actually have quite a bit of standing prior to their training. They actually were involved in some kind of work and were identified by the Adivasi Muneta Sangam, the people's organization. So they're people who had some leadership role prior to their becoming nurses being trained by Ashwini. So when they said something, the people listened to them. So when, for example, there were so many situations where the family would be really, really reluctant to come to the hospital, and the health animators would come and speak with them and say how important it is to go. And they would then just say, okay, fine, I'm ready to go. So the amount of trust that they had for the health animators, and the fact that they knew that the health animators were there totally for them and had no other, you know, ulterior motives either, you know, having, you know, so many cases to be done, you know, so many, you know, there are certain things which are based on outcomes, which sometimes drive people to do things which may be unnecessary. There was none of that in our system. You looked at the individual and recommended what was to be done, and they were very, very comfortable with that. So the whole process of the health's growing has been largely because of the health animators and the health guides, the health volunteers in the villages. These are usually young women in the villages who had basic training and who would work with the health animators, because the villages are so distant. You need to have someone in the village itself pass on the information as who's not well, who's pregnant, and so on for the health animators. So that was critical. So the relationship between the community health nurses and the health volunteers was just fantastic. And that was what made the people very comfortable.
In answer to your question about what they do, the field team, they do not really conduct deliveries or anything, but they follow up all the antenatals. So they have a list of all the antenatals and they make sure that they are getting followed up. They are sent to the hospital for ultrasounds or blood tests. They follow up all the patients who are on treatment for, say, TB. They follow up all the patients on treatment for mental illness, sickle cell disease, or any of these chronic illnesses. We have quite a few patients with sickle cell disease in this area. They follow up all the under fives. The under five children are monitored for growth on a monthly basis. They're given food supplements as necessary. And they pick up all high-risk patients, anybody that might need, like you said, surgery or you know, patients showing symptoms of mental illness, let's say. So their main role is to keep an eye on the community and refer them there. But that being said, they also stock medicines in the area center, and they would treat simple illnesses like somebody comes with a urinary tract infection or an infective diarrhea or, say, sinusitis. And they also keep medicines for chronic patients like hypertension, diabetes. They would check blood sugar there. They can check blood pressure. So these are the things that they do in the field, in the area centers. But in the hospital, the midwives mostly are all tribal. And they would conduct deliveries. They would assist you in surgeries. They are brilliant midwives. They take care of the newborns. They do all the nursing. The lab is all the blood tests, including RT-PCR now for COVID, is all like biology. It's all done by them. They've been trained over the years and they do a great job. If you ask me who I would like as a nurse, I would say one of our tribal nurses, because they are so good at and so meticulous about the way they do things.
Wow, that's pretty high praise. I think reflecting on what you said and having experience with community health workers in a number of different settings through international NGOs, what strikes me as so unique about your program is how holistic it is. And maybe that comes from not having USAID or other large external funding where it's very siloed. And this is a TB program, and so the health workers are doing TB, and this is an HIV program, so the health workers are doing HIV. And what's very different about your community health workers is they're doing everything, because that's what people need, is a little bit of everything. And that's very striking to me.
Absolutely, yeah.
What does it mean when you guys say that the Ashwini and the Goodalar Hospital are owned by the people? And why is this so important?
I think, this is one of our very important, the vision for us is that it should be community owned, because the whole idea is to empower the community. It's not just about providing healthcare services. It's about empowering the community to be able to take care of their own healthcare. We do not want to have beneficiaries. That is a word that is taboo. There are no beneficiaries. These are people that we are empowering, and we are trying to get them to take care of their own health. So naturally, then the whole program at some point needs to be owned by them. It's a long way off. We are talking of people who are barely literate. When, you know, the first group of people who joined us as staff could barely read and write. So we're talking about that generation. But we are confident that over the years, they will be able to take it on and run it. They may need to employ professionals as doctors or specialists or whatever. That's fine. But we would like the whole thing to be in their hands and it to become their program. It's been a gradual process where as and when they are able to take care of a particular activity, that gets handed over to them. And that is how the team has grown to the present day, where they take care of a large number of the operations, including the management, but they need help with certain aspects like fundraising. It's going to be a long time before they get good enough to be able to write proposals or to talk to people and to keep the financial sustainability of the program. So until such time as they are fully capable of running the organization, there will be help from outside. But at some point we envision that this will be totally theirs. It's also very important. From the beginning, we've kept saying that this is yours, this is yours. So there is a feeling of ownership, not just for the staff that are in the hospital, but also for the community. You know, they call it our hospital, which I think is very important. That sense of feeling that, okay, this is our place and we need to keep it going. And there is the whole ambience is very different because the people feel that this is theirs and they have a right to ask for something or the right to, and also the responsibility to do it.
Also, to give you an example, ownership gives you the opportunity to actually decide the future of the institution. To give an example, when we were a 20-bed hospital, Bochaira and I thought that that would be adequate for the tribal population. But, and so we were discussing about our gradual withdrawal and handing over to Dr. Mridula, who's been working with us for many, many years, and who'd be more than competent to handle all the problems. But they came up with the statement that, no, we want a big hospital. So we were very intrigued by that. They said, we said, why do you want a big hospital? 20 beds is more than enough for this population, for your population. They said, no. We have been looking after non-tribals. As nurses, we also take care of non-tribals who come to our hospital. And they said that this has made a tremendous difference in their life. All these years, people looked upon them as, you know, good for nothing. And here, the shoe was on the other foot. We are now taking care of them. And this has changed all the equations in society. We are now looked upon as equals. Now, in the old days, when there was a wedding, we were never invited. Now we are. So this is, we want this to grow so that all our needs will be taken care of by this hospital. And we can also look after the larger population. In our area here, the tribals only make up 10% of the population. 90% are non-tribals. So we need to look after them as well. So we need a big hospital. So then we asked them, so what's our role? She said, your role is to get the money to do this. So it's quite interesting that this came from them. And as a result of which, the 20-bed hospital has grown to the 50-bed well-equipped hospital. So ownership gives you the opportunity to look at your own needs and the aspirations of your community. And owning institutions makes you very powerful because we know that institutions are very powerful in any equation in society.
Wow, I think that's really powerful, the stories you both just told. We talk a lot in our global surgery lab here at UBC about decolonizing global surgery, and it's a fancy term that might be a little hard for people to wrap their heads around, but I think what you just said is really what decolonizing global surgery or global health means, is, as you said, to give ownership and power back to the group that has been disadvantaged and made powerless. Really incredible. We're going back to the story about the $100,000 and talking a little bit about financing. I think a lot of listeners have dreams of one day starting a hospital. I know, and I have since I was a little girl. And $100,000 just really doesn't seem like enough. So I know it was a little while ago, but wanted to ask you, was $100,000 really enough to launch the Ashwini Initiative? And if it wasn't enough to get started, then what was your secret to success in fundraising at that time and over the last few decades in order to keep the hospital growing?
The $100,000 wasn't meant for the work. That was meant for us.
I see.
Understanding there. Yeah,
that was our savings for life, so that we could take care of our family. And
because we were not expecting a salary, so we needed something to live on.
Yeah. Wow. So we when we came over here, we really didn't think about money. We just found the extreme need in Gudalur. And we just rented a building. We just found a building which is large enough, just rented it. And then I wrote to all my alumni, a lot of my classmates and my seniors are in the US and the UK. So I put down the alumni book and wrote to them and said, this is what we're doing. And one of my seniors sent a check for $5,000, which in those days was very, very good. And since we were not taking any salary and everyone was, you know, the salaries were quite low, we were able to manage for a year. And after which funding organizations were, you know, they were willing to fund us, Sebamore, ActionAid, and so on, were willing to support us. So actually, Shaila's the one who's been worrying about finances. I never bothered about finances because I felt somehow the force out there would help us and that the work would continue. And Knockwood, we've always had money. From somewhere or the other, we've had very generous friends who donate huge amounts of money, unbelievable amounts. And I would never have suspected. And that too, without asking them, they've said that at critical times when we really needed the money, it would just come. So we believe in, at least I do.
He does. He believes in his wife, who does all the work.
I see how this works.
So she does a lot of fundraising, writing to friends and writing to donor organizations. And we've been able to grow. Quite consistently over the years because of very strong support from our funding organizations. And also for the training program. Actually, the training program, a huge chunk of our expenses goes in for our nursing program because we need to support these girls as well as construct dormitories and all their needs. So we've had a very fortunate to get a Swiss organization to support us over the years. So through our friends and very serendipitous how things work out. We never expect things to work out, but somehow or the other, It's been very, very heartwarming to find that there's so many people all around the world who've been supporting us for these last 30 odd years.
The Tata Trust, which is one of the big charitable organizations in India, they have funded us for several years. They funded us very heavily for the infrastructure building and apart from all the others and family and friends and. It is a lot of work. I could call myself a professional beggar, but for a worthwhile cause. It is a lot of work. I think it is, one of the more, I shouldn't say more difficult things because, you know, people have been so generous. So it is very fulfilling to do something like that. But it is a lot of work to keep the fundraising going. And as like you mentioned earlier, to make sure that we don't get funding from people who say you can only do this or you can only do that. So we have to be very selective about who we get funding from and make sure that we don't get our hands tied because of the money that has come in.
Also at a personal level, when we needed money, I used to work as a locum in the US. I worked with the Spokane tribe as a locum officer. Usually for somewhere around 6 weeks so that we have enough money, especially when our kids started going to school and they needed funding.
So what I get from all of that is, Nanda Kumar, your advice to all of us who are thinking about this is to find a partner who's an excellent professional beggar. Is that what your advice is?
And have faith in the force.
And have faith in the force. Excellent. Okay, back to you, James.
It sounds like fate to me. It's incredibly heartwarming just to hear about all the support that you guys have had along your journey to, you know, meeting these goals. And, you know, along the line of goals and achievements, Ashwini and the Gudalur Hospital have been exceptionally successful in many different ways. The hospital generates significant revenue every single month. And you guys have drastically reduced maternal and infant mortality rates, created major improvements in overall health outcomes in this region and much more. Could you speak on some of your accomplishments and some of the milestones with this project, as well as their significance in sort of the grand scheme of healthcare delivery for rural and persecuted indigenous populations?
Talking of the milestones, I think the initial days, like I mentioned, the stress was totally on maternal and child care, and also the easily preventable diseases like diarrhea, because a lot of the deaths were from diarrhea. Simple interventions of making the people understand the need for antenatal care, providing immunization to the children, and providing iron, calcium, those kind of supplements, preventing anemia. There used to be several deaths from anemia. I think those were like the easier part of the work, because to us, it was almost like being able to write on a blank wall. There were so many simple things that needed to be corrected. I would think that that was the easy part of the work. So the first 10 years was probably spent on those kind of things. The number of women who delivered in any institution was zero when we started work. And I am proud to say that for the last 10 years, at least more than 90% of the women deliver in one or the other institution, mostly in our institution. So institutional deliveries, preventing complications, maternal mortality has come down for the last 15, 20 years. There is an odd death. Very often, somebody who has sickle cell disease or some other comorbidity, those are the reasons for maternal deaths. But infant mortality has come down from, it was originally around 250 per thousand, from a small survey that was done by Deva and Rupa just before we joined. And today we are down to about 20 per thousand. And those two are, they are mostly extreme premature births or congenital anomalies. So, more than 90% of the women come for their antenatal checkups. I think, so one of our big achievements, I think, has been in the maternal and child morbidity and mortality front, but also in terms of diarrhea deaths. We have not seen a death from diarrhea in the last, say, 15 years. And that's a huge achievement. We have had a community mental health program since 2005, which I think left a big mark, because I identified several people with severe mental illness. There has been no concept of care for patients with mental illness. And by treating these patients, we not only gave a life to the patients, but also a life to their families who were struggling with these patients with psychosis and so on. So the mental health program has been hugely successful, and that's continuing to be there. The other big intervention has been for children with sickle cell disease, all patients with sickle cell disease. We have 300 patients with sickle cell disease in this little center of ours. And these patients are all followed up. They're all on hydroxyurea, vitamins, pneumococcal vaccine. They're admitted as and when they have a crisis, and we have been able to improve the quality of their life to a great extent.
Yeah, so to add to that, one of the very important things in our intervention is that we took people from the community and trained them. Very often the work comes to a halt because you want trained people with degrees, and these people are not available. So one has to train the people themselves, and skill transfer is something that we've shown is quite possible. And people are quite intelligent. They may not have gone through high school and gone into college, but they are very intelligent and they can be taught. I think that's the very important lesson that we've learned. They're very intelligent and capable of taking care of. For example, when a person comes with hypertension, he needs the medicines more than anything else. If he can just get the medicines and someone checks the blood pressure and says, oh, it's okay, and you just repeat the medicines, that itself is a fantastic service, because it's right there at your doorstep. The 8 area centers make health very accessible to the people. And I think that's been a huge, huge step forward, that they don't have to wait to see a doctor to get the medicines. And if there is a problem, then the nurse flags that. And when the doctor comes for the visit, he looks at the patient comes in at the doctor's visit, and then the necessary changes or increase in the medicine or whatever takes place. So I think that huge service of constant care makes a huge difference to the health of the people, that they have someone that they can go to at any time.
Another major milestone has been in our training front. Apart from the nursing training that I was talking to you about, we have had several of our children being sent to universities outside for training in various paramedical courses. We have, someone who's come back with physiotherapy, pharmacy, lab technician, blood banking. We have a girl who's finished her NMPH from none less than TISS, which is a famous institute in India. She's come back and she's joined the community health program. We have several of them doing BSc nursing. Someone has come back with an MSc nursing to teach in our nursing program. So that's another route that we've taken, that we encourage children to go through our sister organization, Vidyodaya, which does the education programs. And children who come out of there and have successfully passed school are placed in programs outside. So we are getting a good a group of people with training in different capacities to come back and be leaders in their community and to provide these skills.
So I love that you refer to these youngsters who go off to train as your children or your kids. And I get the sense that you really do think of them that way. I wanted to ask, because I know you have your own biological children as well, one of whom is a surgeon, and I'm not sure about the others, but can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to raise your kids in this environment, and what lessons you think they may have learned and how it may have impacted their lives, and what they're doing with this vast education that they had in their childhood?
Yeah, that was an adventure. When we came here in 1990, our daughter Gauri was 5 years old and our son Gopal was about three. And I don't know what we thought when we came over here, but so we came here and then we were like, okay, now what about schooling? We went and checked out the local schools and we found it was around 2 PM and we found the one main school that there was over here. The children were all asked to sit with their heads on their desk and the teacher was standing there with a cane. And we said, no, this is not it. And then the next thing you know, we found a tutor to come and tutor them at home. And then some of the other people who joined us, Ramdas and Rama, who were taking care of the, they're a couple who run the education program. And Stan and Mari, the couple who had started work here, they also had children and they were struggling with their children as well. So we put the 7 children together and started a school. How easy was that? So Ramdas and Rama, being in education, they took over and they tutored the children and they found other teachers. And we put up a school in our grounds and the children moved over here. When they saw this, more tribal children also joined. So this actually became a tribal school, which is still running. So Gopal studied here till class 6 or 7 and then went on to a boarding school. Our daughter, unfortunately, has mild mental retardation, so she could not pursue education. She stays with us. She's married and has a son who studied here, again, repeating the same story, and has gone to boarding school now in class 7. I think it's been a wonderful experience for the children. There's a lot to learn from tribal children, if you ask me, from the tribals per se. I think we have learned a lot about how do you respond to nature? How do we take life? You know, how do we take problems that arise in life? It's been it's a calm kind of approach to life. And I think we have learned a lot from that. And hopefully our children have too. Our son can't wait to come back after he finishes his training. So hopefully he'll join us back in Gurlo soon. Yeah, he's doing oncosurgery fellowship now. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure you wouldn't brag about your own children, but just so the audience knows that Dr. Gopal Menon is an accomplished surgeon in his own right, did his master's in public health at Harvard, and as his parents just said, is now doing his surgical oncology fellowship. So I'm sure he'll be a great asset to the global surgery community at large, and of course to your community as well. I have two more questions, one that I'll ask and one that James will ask before we let you go. The first question is, what can those of us in places like Canada, the United States of America, Australia, and New Zealand, developed countries with our own terrible history of colonialism and past and present oppression of Indigenous peoples, learn from the Ashwini and your hospital and foundation's relationship with the Adivasi?
I think the primary thing that has been at least very important for us is to look at the needs of the people. I think it's very important for those who are trying to help not to have their own personal agenda. I wouldn't have come over here and said I would like to set up a surgical institution, or Shaila say that she didn't have a big obstetric outfit. We look at the needs of the people and then we work towards whatever is necessary to answer the needs, whether it's to get professionals or whatever it is. And the second is for the outsiders not to take full control and try to dictate things. It should be a dialogue. Very often in partnerships, there's a very dominant partner and the other person doesn't have much scope in identifying the needs. So I think it's very important for us to put our own baggage aside and just listen to the people and see where we can help them. And I think that will grow because the work gets focused to needs of the people rather than to the people who are coming in. And the second would be that the people who are coming from outside have skills. They're basically technical people. They have knowledge in certain areas, and that's what they have come to transfer. But things like culture and the way that people live, I think should be left strictly alone. Let them decide how they would like to run their lives. Our job is to provide them with those things which they really need as far as education is concerned, for healthcare is concerned, and to use that as a group decision as to what we need next and to help them with that. I think that's very, very important. And to start the training wherever they are, even if they've reached class 5 or class 6 or wherever, to use those skills and those people to build them up rather than have outsiders who keep coming in and going out without transferring their skills and their knowledge. I think that's the single most important thing, to listen to the needs of the people and to transfer those skills and to get out once that's done.
I'd just like to add that, not everybody can go and start a hospital and spend their lives in some remote area. But there are several things that I feel that even people, even if you live in Ontario, can still contribute to needy places, which you've probably realized from your global surgery postings and so on. The thing is, I think to have relationship with any one organization somewhere where you would be able to go and give your skills, train people there with those skills and so on. We have several such people who have been associated with us over the years. We have my friends, the gynecologist. They come. Whenever we call them, we line up cases, they come, they operate, they go. We have orthopedicians who have been coming regularly. They have a relationship with us. We can tell them, we have a cardiologist, we send her the ECG or the symptoms of the patient. She tells us what to do. And then she would come once a month, do all the echoes and so on. So it is a relationship that these people, several of them, have had with us over the past 30 years. And lots of such things can be done by people, even if they cannot go and start their own unit and spend their whole life in a remote area. Just wanted to add that.
Yeah, I think that's a very important message, that we all have our piece of the puzzle to add. And even if we can't put the whole puzzle together, we can contribute in some way, whether it's in our own local community or in somewhere far away.
And a sort of philosophical question here. If you had to choose sort of one actionable item with a clear time-bound target, something that could advance surgical care in your region and in your country as a whole, what do you think that it would be?
I think the single most important thing would be decentralization, especially in India. Most of the care here is being provided by tertiary care hospitals located in the urban areas. We have a huge lack of secondary care hospitals. And what we've demonstrated, and many other hospitals who, like ours, working in rural areas, has demonstrated that more than 80 to 90% or the problems that we face can be handled right here. Unfortunately, since this number is quite small, most of the patients have to be referred to the tertiary care hospitals, and they have to be a huge part of a huge group of patients who need care. And this decreases the quality of care in the tertiary care hospitals by overloading them, and also prevents them from taking care of the more complicated cases and spending time on research. So if I had my way, I would decentralize surgical care and the teaching care. All teaching care is now taking place in medical colleges in urban areas. I would decentralize that and make our county, which you call our district hospitals, and our sub-district hospitals as teaching centers, so that we would have youngsters come in and be actually exposed to what's happening in rural areas. They can see the needs that are there and be trained appropriately. Your training in the urban setting is very, very different from what is actually required by a large chunk of our country. India is still about 60 to 70% rural population. So unless our youngsters are exposed to care and the way it needs to be delivered in a rural area, they're never going to venture out. It's going to be extremely difficult for them, who are totally city-based kids, to come out and work in rural areas. So I would just decentralize the whole teaching system that we have, so that teaching filters all the way down to our sub-district hospitals, and we have medical students and postgraduates posted here, so that the ordinary care, like we said, 80% of care can be delivered within medicine, surgery, and all the allied things can be delivered right here in the close to their homes.
No, I totally agree with Nandakumar. Decentralization is the way to go. We have so many government hospitals. They call the primary health centers, which are fairly well equipped. They can, if it's built up, it can take care of most of the problems of the people, and it's so much easier for the people to be. It gives them access, and it cuts down on the amount of expenses that they need for going to a city. So decentralization is the way to go. I only wish they would build up the peripheral hospitals.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear you say that. One of our earlier guests, Dr. Emmanuel Makasa, is a big proponent of surgical care at the district hospital level in sub-Saharan Africa. And personally, having worked exclusively in district hospitals in sub-Saharan Africa, I can attest that that's the way to go. You cut out a lot of people when you only provide care in large centers, because the fact of the matter is that most people cannot get to the capital. So you're immediately excluding them from healthcare.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's been such a pleasure to have you both on our podcast. You are so inspiring and have shared so many words of wisdom. I've been texting with our podcast creator, Paul, to highlight some little tidbits of knowledge that I really want you to be known for. One of them that I really struck me was there are no beneficiaries. And I think that that phrase can really turn the idea of global health or global surgery on its head when you change your mind from charity to empowerment. So thank you so much. Our last question for you before we let you go is something we've been asking all of our guests. Who would you recommend that we host next?
I think if you're looking at its health, right? Yeah, I think both of us would agree this. Dr. Reggie and Lalita?
Yeah. So there's an organization called the Tribal Health Initiative in Sipilingi, where they have a very similar structure to ours, but they have gone a lot more into the community with working with the government and working with the people for
livelihoods, a lot of farming and livelihoods
projects.
Apart from the health work, they're a lovely, brilliant couple.
Yeah. They have a large reserve forest where they have a lot of tribal people. So they've been able to work with them with improving their livelihood and improving their economic situation. So that's Tribal Health Initiative, Sitilingi.
Wonderful.
Reggie and Lalita.
Well, thank you so much. So that officially wraps up our episode 7. Thank you again to our really incredible guests who I'm sure have inspired all of you as much as they've inspired James and myself. Thanks for joining us today on Off the Table podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to Off the Table, a global surgery podcast. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. You can also find show notes and more information about past and future episodes on our website, www.patreon.com www.offthetablepodcast.com/offthetablepodcast. If you have comments or suggestions, you can email us at offthetablepod21@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram, OTT_globalsurgery, and Twitter, offthetable_pod. We hope that you join us on our next episode.